Many blind people struggle with sleep issues because it's difficult for our brain to register day and night. We also have more nightmares than sighted people, but that's besides the point. Like many disabled people, I find I need more sleep than my able-bodied peers because I have to expend more energy to accomplish the same amount of tasks. With the help of my blackout curtains, my Himalayan salt lamp, a cup of magnesium before bed, melatonin, and a good audiobook, I manage to get great sleep. So much so that it can be difficult to drag myself out of bed in the mornings. I get creatively inspired and fueled at night, so I tend to stay up late and sleep in. I'm a typical night owl, and I easily need 10 or even 12 hours of sleep a night, which I know sounds like a lot. But because I run my own business, I often have the luxury of getting to start my days later than most. Like most millennials, once I'm awake, I grab my laptop and prop myself up with some pillows. I check my Instagram, Twitter, and email, and usually pick a YouTube video to start my day off with. I do all of this using VoiceOver, a talking program designed by Apple for blind and low vision users. And I can't really start my day out without a nice warm cup of fresh lemon water to cleanse my liver and a good smoothie. I'm a bit of a creature of habit because I lack so much control and freedom in other aspects of my life. It helps me feel safe to have a routine with a few things that are predictable every day. When I don't have my lemon water and my smoothie every morning, I can feel a little anxious. A few more things you need to know about me, courtesy of Molly's Weird Food Facts. I hate fruit salad where all the fruits are touching, but I love fruit smoothies where all the fruit is blended. Cooked fruit should never happen, and it should never be part of a dessert, even pie. I eat exclusively with forks, and I prefer all of my food cold instead of hot. All of it. On my rare lazy days, I just chill in bed and watch Netflix for a bit. I'm currently binging Friends for what is probably the 10th time in my life. Since it's a show that I grew up watching in my sighted days, and it's a show so based on dialogue, I find I don't miss too much. There are some shows that I just can't watch alone if they don't have a described video option, because I get too lost not knowing what's happening on the screen. Pretty Little Liars, here's looking at you. In general, shows like Law & Order SVU or Grey's Anatomy are the easiest for me to watch alone, because the dialogue is so descriptive that I don't need any extra help to know what's going on. In fact, some shows are written like this on purpose. It's called integrated audio description. Innovations like audio description and voiceover probably make it as good a decade as any to be blind. I use Siri, and I have smart appliances from Samsung in my apartment. These innovations, along with my trusty guide dog Gallup, are some of the many tools I use to live and work independently. One question that often gets asked in the comment section of my videos is why I use words like look and see when I can't and I didn't. Frankly, it would just be weird to remove those words from my vocabulary just because I can't see. How weird would it be if we were having a conversation and I said, I was listening to Friends the other day? Or, I felt this really cute top at the mall. One example of when you might do this is if you read an article about the benefits of ginger. But then you go, I heard about the benefits of ginger. You didn't hear it, you read it, but it still makes sense. As a blind person, there are already so many ways I feel alienated from society. So I'm not going to do something that would only make me feel even more different. Now that I've explained all that, let me get back to my morning routine. By the time I've managed to drag myself out of bed, it's usually between 9:30 and 10:30 a.m. if I didn't have something like a meeting or a flight to get up for earlier. I usually plan out my outfit the night before and have it placed on my vanity ready for the next morning. Organization is really important to me. I make sure everything has its place so I can easily find things when I need them. When it comes to picking my outfits, I do everything from memory and touch. I pretty much have memorized what all my clothes look like based on descriptions my sighted minions have given me. I've also memorized where pretty much everything in my apartment is, and always put things back where they belong. Blind people often have extraordinary memories because we rely on them so heavily. Maybe that's why I love elephants so much. By going around my well-organized closet, I'm able to feel each piece and pick which ones I want to go together. Next up, I do my whole in-depth skincare routine and put on my makeup. Some of my makeup is labeled with Braille or tactile markers. Others are just placed in very specific spots on my vanity, which, side note, does not have a mirror. Just a shiny sequined wall. Blind girl perk, I could do my makeup in bed if I wanted to. In fact, I used to in high school. My love of makeup and fashion is actually how I got into YouTube. When I was 14, alone and feeling so down in my room, I used to watch YouTube videos on makeup. I would watch girls like Juicy Star 07, Megan Hart's makeup, or Mac Barbie 07, aka YouTube icon Bethany Moda. Oh, the days of cringy usernames. No shade, girls. I listened and I learned. It was shortly after getting into the beauty and lifestyle community on YouTube that I started thinking one day I'd give it a try and take my love of performing in front of the camera. Here's another question people ask me. How can you be blind but love things like makeup and tattoos that you can't even see? This is easy. Sighted Molly loved these things, so blind Molly does too. Going blind didn't change who I am. It changed how I do things, how I live, how I interact with the world around me. For me, these things that were once so visual no longer are. Makeup is about the enjoyment of putting it on and playing with new products. I like how feminine it makes me feel. Tattoos are about showing the world little pieces of my story, and fashion helps me express how I feel. They always say, when you look good, you feel good. Just feeling like I look good and knowing I put in effort makes me feel confident. With home decor, I love being in an environment that feels comfortable, homey, and personal. All of these things become about my emotions and my other senses, not how things visually look. And come on, who wouldn't want a wall of stuffed animals and faux fur blankets everywhere? So cozy. Speaking of senses, when you go blind or lose another sense, it's not like you become a superhero and have your other senses heightened overnight. I simply rely on my other senses so heavily that I'm more in tune with them. For people with all five senses, or six if you believe in ghosts, the sense you rely on most is sight. So when you're not constantly stimulated by taking in visual input, your brain has so much more room to focus on what you're smelling, tasting, touching, and hearing. Oh, and while we're on the topic of superheroes, never compare me to Daredevil. Thank you. LA has always been part of the plan. I was just 5 years old when I told my parents that I was going to move to LA one day, even though I never visited until I was 19. I actually still have a school project I made when I was in grade six. Yes. Project, not project. I'm Canadian. We say project. We basically had to make vision boards for the next 10 years of our lives. I made mine look like a film reel from a movie, and every frame documented my life living in LA and working in the entertainment industry. I may have included a few Ferraris, Oscars, and Grammys by the time I turned 21. So basically, I've never had a problem dreaming big. When people ask if I moved to LA for work, I always tell them that's the third reason on the list. Of course, working in entertainment, it's definitely a lot easier being out here. But the second reason on the list was the weather. Honestly, I think I'm allergic to the cold, and I mean that with all seriousness. I can barely function in anything less than 25 degrees. That's 77 degrees Fahrenheit for you Americans. But the number one reason I moved here is because blind Molly wants to let sighted Molly live her dreams. I encourage each and every one of you to never let challenges or bumps in the road stop you from following your dreams and being exactly who you want to be. We're all going to take some unexpected turns, but it doesn't mean you won't reach the destination you set out for. Living in LA is a dream come true. It's better than I ever could have hoped. Even when things aren't going amazing, I'm just grateful to wake up and do what I love. In a way, my mom was a big source of inspiration for my move. She moved from Ireland to Canada when she was 27 to start her life over again. Just like me, she hadn't always had an easy life. So she went to Canada for a fresh start. And I felt the same way when it was finally time for me to move to LA. I needed to let go of everything I had been through. In Toronto, I felt like I was the bullied blind girl. But in LA, I feel like I'm Molly. When I meet people, I'm this outgoing, funny, successful, bubbly girl. I'm myself. I finally have the physical distance I needed to move on from the pain of my past. Since this is LA, there's no getting anywhere without a car. And that means ride-sharing apps. Because driving is obviously not an option for me. My mom and I have a system for ride shares. Here's how we do it. I go out first and I hide. That's right, I hide around the corner with my guide dog Gallop. Then my mom goes out and waits for the car. When it pulls up, she opens the back door and says, "Hi, this car's for me." My daughter's blind. She has a guide dog. So if you could just pull the passenger seat forward, the dog will sit on the floor. Meanwhile, she holds open the back door so they can't drive away. Then I walk up with Gallop, who lays on the floor peacefully like a good guide dog, and my mom gets in last. It's kind of sad that we have to have this system, but it works. We've learned to do this because sometimes the cars drive away when they see Gallop. How could they? Gallop is so adorable. This literally happened to me just the other day. The car came early and I hadn't had a chance to get to my hiding spot yet. The back door was locked. And when my mom opened the front door, the driver turned to her and said, "You can't come in. No dogs. No dogs." My mom tried to explain that I'm blind and Gallop is a guide dog. And when he was still trying to keep us out, I just reached in, opened the back door, and let myself in. The driver was not happy and told us he was going to call the police. So we told him, go right ahead, because he was the one breaking the law. And the ride-sharing app's policy of allowing guide dogs. So then he asked me for my dreaded certificate. You know, the thing that doesn't exist. So I filled him in and let him know that the ADA law states he's only allowed to ask me two questions. One, is that a service dog? And two, what service does it provide? After that whole spiel, he was like, fine, I'll go. And started driving really recklessly while taking photos of me and my mom. He wanted to get me kicked off the ride-sharing app for having a dog in his car. When in fact, he's the one that will get kicked off the app for treating me like that because it's against the company policy. Since he's the one who brought it up in the first place, my mom pulled up the app's policy on service dogs and started calmly reading it word for word. It was somehow both chill and sassy, which completely sums up my mom's vibe. Meanwhile, keep in mind, the whole reason we had requested this ride is because we had somewhere to be. We were on our way to a meeting, and now we were going to be late. When we finally got to the destination, my mom said, "You know, an apology to my daughter would go a long way." And he replied, "I have nothing to say," before driving off. That's my life, people. Every day is a journey. This is the stuff I face every single day. I just try my best to let it roll off my back and not let it get to me. Trust me, I've had lots of practice. Here in LA, I've made new friends and even dated a bit. And yes, blind girls go on blind dates too. I actually find the term funny because it allows me to make a lot of puns. Anywho, even though I've been dating, it's been 4 years since I've been in a relationship. At first, I was really happy being single, focusing on myself and my career. But in the past year, I've been in a place where I'd really love to find someone to share it with. Why does that have to be so difficult, people? Although it might sound shallow, I'm still pretty picky about what I find physically attractive. What can I say? I'm only human. Able-bodied people are always putting blind people on a pedestal, which is something my blind girlfriends and I complain to each other about a lot. Well-meaning people will say things like, "Oh, it's so nice that you can just fall in love with people for who they are." Sighted people always assume that blind people don't have any physical preferences because we can't see what our partners look like, but that's just not true. Physical attraction is important to me too. I'm 4'10½", so I don't like super tall guys because they make me feel overpowered. I also hate body and facial hair. It's a texture thing. I don't like feeling hair on a guy's arm when he's guiding me, so I like really smooth men. It's a weird Mollyism. But they do have to have hair on their heads, but not like a man bun, because then I feel like I'm kissing a girl, and that's just not my thing. Oh, and I love me some good, strong, muscular arms. Some people want me to live on this pedestal where I'm like, yes, us blind people live this magical, wonderful life where we never judge anyone. But that's exactly what I'm trying to fight against. I'm trying to show people that we're normal as hell, which includes making the occasional shallow dating decision just like any other 25-year-old. Another thing that comes up a lot is that able-bodied people feel this need to congratulate disabled people just for functioning. They use our existence as a source of inspiration, which has a name. It's called inspiration porn, as the late Stella Young put it in her 2014 hilarious TED Talk about disability. Totally worth the watch, by the way. She was a very feisty and cute Australian woman with a brilliant mind. If I'm doing something totally normal, like ordering my coffee at Starbucks, and a stranger comes up to me and says, "Wow, I just find this really inspiring," it's a little patronizing. You would never congratulate an able-bodied person for ordering coffee, so why are you congratulating me? It's like the only version of disability people know is the stereotype, and they can't believe I'm out there functioning in the world, wearing makeup, looking put together, and without any dark sunglasses. But the reality is, lots of us are doing this. This is the real image of disability. Of course, it's okay to be inspired by disabled people, just like it's okay to be inspired by able-bodied people. What's not okay is being inspired by all disabled people just because we're disabled. This happens a lot during prom season, which I swear is inspiration porn heaven. Every year, some story goes viral like, "He asked her to prom even though she has Down syndrome. What a hero!" No one would ever think that's okay if the headline was, "He asked her to prom even though she's Asian. What a hero!" Everyone would be in an uproar. But for some reason, we're all okay exploiting the disabled person. People have even congratulated my ex-boyfriend for dating me. Think of how you would feel if somebody was praised for asking you on a date. It's dehumanizing. Disabled people are all too often portrayed as being mentally unaware. So everyone treats us like we don't realize we're being pitied and acting like people deserve trophies for being our friend. That's exactly what happened to me when I was a kid and my teacher gave my friend that stuffed animal. At 8 years old, I already understood that somebody basically had to be paid to be my friend, and that broke me. Yes, it's important to respect and empathize with the challenges we do face. But everyone faces challenges, disabled or not. I don't know the challenges that somebody else faced to get up and get their coffee that morning, and they don't know mine. They just think they do because I'm disabled. So they assume my life must automatically be worse. And I don't think that's a healthy way of thinking. While they mean well, these kind of compliments are really more about the other people than they are about me. People feel bad about the prospects that they too could end up blind. So they patronize me with kindness to make themselves feel better. If someone wants to chat with me at the coffee counter, there are so many better ways to go about it. If I seem like I might need help, it's okay to say, "Hey, do you need some help?" Like, that's always nice to offer. And then I might say, "Yeah, would you mind grabbing me a lid for the tall drink?" And then, "Thanks so much. I hope you have a great day." Just don't do the whole, "I'm so inspired by the fact that you're out here getting coffee" thing. Talk to us like we're human, because that's who we are. Chapter 6. I get by with a little help from my four-legged friend. The most important tool in my life, in so many ways, is my guide dog. Gallup and I are together 24/7. We're never apart. In fact, he's here in the recording studio with me right now. And he's number one in my life. Right, babe? Yes, okay. He agrees. It was a silent agree. I've had two different dogs in the 12 years that I've been a guide dog user. Gallup and Gypsy are my babies. I always joke that I was a teen mom because I got my first guide dog Gypsy when I was just 13, which is really uncommon, especially back then. It's not easy to be approved for a guide dog, but it's even harder when you're younger than 18 because it's such a huge responsibility. If my guide dog got sick, it meant I would be missing school to take her to the vet. It was up to me to walk her, scoop up her poop, and clean up after her if she got sick at 3 a.m. See what I mean? My babies. Contrary to what a lot of people think, you don't just get a guide dog handed to you for being blind. Luckily, a lot of charities and nonprofits help blind people get guide dogs. Because they aren't government-funded or covered by insurance, and they are really expensive. The dogs go through years of training from the time they're just six-week-old puppies. And the cost of that alone can be anywhere from $20,000 to $60,000, depending on the facility. My guide dogs were trained at the Mira Foundation in Quebec, which was the only school that trained guide dogs for children at the time. Guide dogs have public access rights, which means they can go anywhere I can go. It's actually illegal to deny them access, even if there's a no pet policy. So the dogs have to go through extensive training and pass a public access test to make sure they're ready for it. No aggression, barking, getting distracted, eating off restaurant tables, losing control of their bladder, getting spooked by loud noises, or anything like that. They also have to be smart enough to learn a lot of unique commands. And above all, they have to want to work. If they don't love what they're doing, they don't pass. Owning a pet is a big responsibility, but having a guide dog is so much more than that. It's a relationship filled with trust, and it's such an incredibly unique and deep bond. Because of this, their handlers also have to go through extensive evaluations and training. They have to have the right lifestyle to suit a service dog. They have to be mature, independent, and responsible enough to take care of a dog. And perhaps most importantly, before you can even be considered to get a guide dog, you have to demonstrate that you have proper orientation and mobility skills with a white cane. O&M for short. You have to have spatial awareness and be able to listen to audio cues from the world around you. Those are the minimum requirements. When I decided I wanted a guide dog, I had to prove that I could do all of that and more. When I was 8 years old, I had to hone my cane skills because it became unsafe for me to go without one. The only thing that kept me going was the idea that one day I would get a guide dog. At the time, dogs were one of my biggest fears. But I was determined to get over that fear because I already knew that getting a guide dog would open up my life in so many ways. Mira's age limit was 13, although they've now lowered it to 11. So my heart was set on getting my first guide dog by the time I turned 13. During my 7th grade March break, that's what we call our spring break in Canada. Maybe because March doesn't feel like spring yet? I finally went to Montreal for my evaluation at the Mira Foundation. In order to show them my independence and maturity, I took the 6-hour train ride on my own. I brought a carry-on filled with audiobooks and my Daisy player, which was an 8-pound, 5x8-inch machine that played special audiobooks from the Canadian National Institute for the Blind. Knowing me, I probably listened to one of the Shopaholic books by Sophie Kinsella on the way there. Once I arrived, the Mira Foundation did their best to make me feel comfortable. But I was still on edge because I felt like I was being watched the entire time. This was my chance to achieve a goal I had had for 5 years, and it had the potential to make a big impact on my life. I didn't want to mess this up and have to wait another year. Over the next few days, Natalie, the guide dog trainer, and Hélène, the O&M instructor, evaluated me. No pressure! I had to memorize certain walking routes with tactile braille maps, and then walk those routes with my cane while being evaluated from 15 feet away. I was not allowed to ask for help. They also tested my auditory skills. I had to close my eyes while they turned me around in circles on the sidewalk. and then I had to figure out which direction to turn so the traffic would be on my left. Then Natalie brought me to meet some dogs in the kennel to see how I would interact with them. And, funny enough, I met Gypsy that day, having no idea that she would eventually be going home with me. When I first met Gypsy, she was too much for me. She reminded me of the dogs I grew up being afraid of. Fear of animals is pretty common when you're blind, because most animals obviously don't understand that you can't see and you have no way to explain it to them. You can't see where they're going, what they're doing, or what they're trying to tell you with their physical cues. So when a large dog with lots of energy jumps up on a blind person and licks their face, it can be pretty intense and terrifying. Gypsy was this big ball of loving energy and made me a little nervous. I felt so anxious the last day when I was packing up my things to go home. I knew Natalie and Hélène were going to come and tell me my fate. Would I be accepted into the July class to get my first guide dog? Or would I have to wait another year, work on my skills, and come back and be reevaluated? When they came in, my bags were packed and they seemed really serious. They reviewed all the different evaluations they had done with me. And then they said, "What we've determined is you've passed with flying colors. And we'd love to have you back in July to get your first guide dog." I could just hear the smiles on their faces. It was so hard to go back home and finish the school year after that. But then July finally rolled around, and I went back to Montreal to spend a month training with my first guide dog. I packed snacks, Perrier water, and good walking shoes because I knew I'd be walking a lot. And my audiobooks, of course. I probably read The Giver 10 times that month because I didn't have anyone my own age to talk to in Montreal. Back at the Mira Foundation, I woke up at 6 a.m. every morning for a full day of training. And at the end of the day, I'd be so exhausted, I would just collapse into bed after a quick dinner and calling my parents. This was also around the same time that I started noticing more dramatic changes in my vision. And it was all taking a toll on my energy. Thank God Natalie, Hélène, and the other trainer, Isabel, spoke some English because hardly anyone else in my class did. There were about 8 of us altogether. And besides one older Quebecois woman named Jeanette, everyone else had flown in from France just to get their guide dogs. A lot of Canadian kids learn French in school. But I had taken Braille as my second language credit. So my French was very limited to things like, "Bonjour, je m'appelle Molly. Est-ce que je peux aller à la toilette? Pamplemousse, ananas." While I was training with my dog that month, I also had to learn all the French commands from scratch. Unlike most guide dog schools, the Mira Foundation doesn't pre-match guide dog to handler. In fact, Mira doesn't do most things the way other guide dog schools do it. As someone who marches to the beat of my own drum, I love that about them. Just because everyone else is doing something one way doesn't mean it's the right way. At Mira, you actually get to be a part of the decision when you get paired with your guide dog. During the first few days, we all spent time in the kennels with different dogs. I worked 3 dogs. A yellow lab named Java, a petite black lab named Cleo, and Gypsy, a black and white Labernese. All of us worked through obstacle courses with our dogs, feeling out their speed, walking style, and personality. And then we spent some time just getting to know them, giving them commands, petting them, and getting a general sense of their vibe. After all of this, you have a conversation with the trainers and, together, you all decide on the best match. I'm not gonna lie. My first choice was Cleo. But the trainers and Gypsy were all pretty set on the fact that Gypsy was the right one for me. In fact, when the other students tried to test drive Gypsy, instead of guiding them through the obstacle course, she would guide them right over to me and she'd sit at my feet. In hindsight, the choice was pretty clear. Gypsy was so beautiful. We used to get stopped everywhere we'd go, just so people could tell us how beautiful she was. I used to joke with kids that she had walked in paint, because her forepaws were perfectly white, and her tail had a white tip, just like a paintbrush. She had a white milk spill right across her chest, a white racing stripe between her eyes, and a pastel pink birthmark on her white snout just above her nose. If you drew a cartoon of a dog, it would look like Gypsy. She was so perfectly spotted, it looked like she had been drawn. Talk about highlight and contour. Hers were on point. She was hot and she knew it. Gypsy and I were so alike in what we enjoyed doing, with just a couple of exceptions. She didn't like shopping, probably because it wasn't enough about her. And she was big on catching bugs. If a bug were flying anywhere nearby, she would jump up, catch it, and eat it. Flies, bees, wasps, it didn't matter. I don't know how she managed it, but she never got stung. And trust me, if she had gotten stung, she would have made sure I knew about it. That girl was the first to yelp if anything was even remotely uncomfortable. And she never passed up an opportunity for attention. Gypsy was my rock. She was with me through everything. The vision loss, bullying, and school transfers. My first boyfriend and my first breakup. She was even my date to prom. I had to turn down the guy who asked me to prom because Gypsy had asked me first. That night, her entire harness was covered in flowers to match my wrist corsage. And she proceeded to spend the entire night eating all of those flowers. When it was time to dance, I'd tap my shoulders and she'd jump up to put her paws around my neck. Then I'd put my arms behind her back and we'd slow dance. She was with me when I graduated from high school, when I moved into my first apartment in Toronto, and while I traveled the world speaking to audiences. Guide dogs typically work for 6 to 8 years, and the Mira Foundation does annual checkups on their dogs to make sure they're fit to keep working. After Gypsy and I had been together for 7 years, I was pretty sure she'd still be working for me for at least another year. I knew her guiding was still safe. Sure enough, at her annual checkup, she was approved for another year. A few weeks later, I noticed that Gypsy was starting to get a little gassy. She was eating slower and leaving some food behind in her bowl. Just like I always did when she got sick, I took her to the vet. They gave us some tummy medicine and special food. Her tummy problems seemed to get a bit better, but I could tell there was still something wrong. She just wasn't fully there. I took her back to the vet again and told them something's not right. They ran some blood tests, but everything came back normal. When you have a service dog, you have a special bond. They know when something's wrong with you, and you know when something's wrong with them. I knew something was wrong with Gypsy, even though the blood tests were normal and the vet kept telling me it was just a stomach bug. By this point, she was throwing up frequently. She even threw up at the airport right before we got on a plane. And then she threw up on stage while I was giving a speech. I had been so worried about her, and that was the last straw. As soon as I got back from my work trip, I took her to the vet and demanded they figure out what was going on. When the vet did an x-ray, they saw that something was obstructing Gypsy's bowels. They'd explained that she had most likely eaten something and wasn't able to pass it. Another possibility was colitis, which was treatable. Or they said it could also be cancer, but that wasn't likely. Either way, they would have to schedule an exploratory surgery in a few days. When I called the Mira Foundation to let them know she'd be going in for surgery, they told me they trusted me to do what was right for Gypsy, and that meant a lot to me. Gypsy always wagged her tail, no matter what was going on in her life. Happy, sad, scared, her tail was always going. But all of a sudden, that had changed. She was depressed. When she would throw up, she'd hide her face, and I could tell she was embarrassed. It was devastating to see her like this. All this time, I had been praying she would get better. But that night, I laid beside her in her pink donut bed and just prayed for whatever was best to happen. I stopped selfishly praying for her to get better, and I started truly praying for her. The next morning, I called the vet, and I begged them to see her earlier, because I just couldn't bear to see her like this any longer. The vet understood what Gypsy meant to me, and she agreed to come in on her day off. When we arrived, they brought us into the surgical waiting room where I said a quick goodbye, knowing I'd see her again when she woke up from surgery in a few hours. It was the longest day of my life. The vet told me that the longer I didn't hear from them, the better. I had been sitting at home with my parents for several hours, so I was starting to get hopeful. Eventually, my mom called to check in, and they told her Gypsy hadn't even gone into surgery yet because there had been a delay. A few hours later, the phone rang. They had found the source of the bowel obstruction. Some sticks and leaves had gotten stuck in her bowels and couldn't pass. She had probably been eating them because she felt sick. But the reason they couldn't pass is because they had found a 5-inch tumor. The cancer had already spread through her whole body, and there was nothing they could do. There was nothing I could do either, other than ask if I could go say goodbye. My parents drove me back to the vet, and when I walked into the operating room, she was asleep on the table with a blanket covering her body and a tube sticking out of her throat, breathing for her. It was just after 4 p.m. on May 22nd when I held her paw and I said goodbye. She was 9.5 years old. I knew deep down that Gypsy wouldn't live forever, but I never expected to lose her so suddenly. She was my eyes. Losing a creature that you rely on so much is like no feeling anyone could ever understand. It's like losing a limb. When I lost Gypsy, I lost my independence. I lost my confidence, my navigation skills, and my connection to society. I lost my best friend, my baby girl. I'll never forget that the last place she guided me was to her own surgery. Once she was gone, I hit rock bottom. I would just lie on the bathroom floor, hold her squeaky toy, and cry for hours. I carried that squeaky toy around with me for a week. It was the last toy she ever played with in the car on her way to surgery, and I felt like letting go of it would mean letting go of Gypsy, too. Finally, on the 1-week anniversary of her passing, I went to her favorite park and left it beside a tree with a bouquet of daisies to say goodbye. I had battled depression in school, but this was one of the most difficult moments of my life. I can honestly say that I'd personally take depression over anxiety any day. This is not to discount how difficult depression is. As someone who dealt with such severe depression that I considered suicide, I understand how tough it can be. But with depression, I just felt numb, like I was dead inside. Versus the anxiety I had after losing Gypsy, which made me feel like I was on a roller coaster 24/7. Anxiety was a living hell trapped inside my own body. I couldn't eat, I couldn't think, I couldn't breathe, I couldn't function. I just had to pace. I would pace the bathroom again and again, and that's it. That was my life. It's exhausting to live like that. This period in my life was as dark as the time I had gone blind in grade 8. I was already dealing with a few personal and professional difficulties when Gypsy got sick. And when I lost her so suddenly, it felt like everything I had worked so hard to build was falling apart all over again. But what made this round of loss and mental illness different is that this time I knew I could get through it because I had already done it once. I had gained all of these tools and life lessons from my first battle. And I knew I could ask for help this time. It didn't make this fight easy, but it was a game changer just to know that I could and would get through it. 2.5 months later, I went back to the Mira Foundation to get my next guide dog. I tried 5 different dogs this time, and I really wanted this St. Pierre named Mistral. I thought his French name was really weird, so I just called him Milo. He was this little furball with long black and white hair. I think I wanted him so badly because out of all the dogs I tried, he reminded me the least of Gypsy. But after 2 days with him, the trainers and I agreed it just wasn't working. So they insisted on trying me with Gallop. I had never walked with Gallop before. And when I did, it just didn't feel right. But the trainers felt otherwise. I begrudgingly agreed to walk around town with him. And when I got back to the cafe where the other guide dog handlers were waiting, I burst into tears. I just sobbed for hours because he wasn't Gypsy. Physically, Gypsy and Gallop were enough alike that his size and short hair made him feel like her, but he wasn't her. I felt like I was betraying Gypsy. I called my parents and told them to come get me. I was going to go home without a dog. But the guide dog trainer said, give him the weekend. If you still feel the same way as you do now on Monday, then we'll let you go and your parents can come get you. But you need to give Gallop a chance. That afternoon, we were relaxing in the lounge after a long day. I was sitting alone on the couch and Gallop was at my feet, because the dogs are trained to stay off the furniture. You can choose if you want to let them on the furniture once you get home. But when they're in puppy training, they have to stick to the rules. I was still feeling really down when Gallop stood up, put his butt on the couch beside me, like a little human, but with all four paws on the ground, and he looked over at me. It was like he was saying, yeah, I know. I know I'm not Gypsy. I'm sorry. And I just burst out laughing. He was like, I get it. And I just knew if a dog could make me laugh like that when I was in such a bad place, I just had to give him a chance. Now, I can't imagine my life without Gallop. He isn't Gypsy, but he's full of his own personality. He loves cheese of any kind. It's the only food he's ever broken the rules for and stolen off a plate. He rarely ever barks. For the entire first year he was with me, I didn't hear him bark even once. He snores as loud as an old man, and I'm pretty sure his side hustle is professional napping. He likes playing frisbee, but he'll only run for the frisbee two or three times before he's ready to nap again. He's almost as big as I am. In fact, we both weighed exactly 85 pounds when we got each other. We've both gained a bit of weight since then. But he has zero clue about his own size. He loves running between people's legs, even when he barely fits. And he's always getting stuck under things he thinks he can fit under. He's also super snuggly and spends the whole night going between my bed and his. Last but not least, he has a weird obsession with men in their 20s and 30s. I think he's trying to play matchmaker and find me a boyfriend. And I say that in all seriousness. Gypsy used to do this thing all the time that I've never seen any other dog do, but she was famous for it. She used to dig on linoleum floors because she absolutely hated the texture. She would dig so hard that it was like she was trying to dig a little hole to China. In the 5 years I've had Gallop, he's done it just a handful of times. And every time I'm like, oh, Gypsy's here. He pretty much only does it when I go back to places that Gypsy would have guided me, like my old high school or sick kids hospital. All of a sudden, Gallop will just start randomly digging, and I know Gypsy is visiting through him. One day, I'll have to say goodbye to Gallop too. The hard reality that no one talks about when you get a guide dog is that you become so bonded to them, but they don't live forever. I've been told that grieving the first dog and transitioning to the second is the hardest, because you've never had to be guided by any other dog before. Even though I'm still dreading that day with Gallop, I don't try to hide from it anymore. I don't joke that he'll live forever, like I did with Gypsy. Saying goodbye to my dog will never be easy. But at least now I know how to deal with it head on. I know how important it is to cherish the time we have, and to keep moving forward no matter what. And I know I'll be able to get through it, just like last time, and the time before that. Intermission. What I wish everyone knew about service dogs. Well, that was depressing, and I'm very proud of myself for getting through it without bursting into tears. Although we definitely have a good audio clip of me crying if you want that. P.S. You don't. I've been a guide dog user for 12 years. In that time, I have probably had thousands of conversations with strangers who have come up to me wanting to talk about my dog. It's one of the reasons I decided to get a guide dog in the first place. No one comes up to the girl with the cane and says, "How old's your cane? What's its name?" But everyone talks to the girl with the guide dog, and I love that. I love meeting people and telling them all about my dog. I've always viewed it as a chance to educate and break down stereotypes. That's not something every blind person wants to do, but I feel like it's my calling in life. In all the conversations I've had with people about my dog over the years, one question I get asked a lot is about the difference between guide dogs and service dogs. So let's get into it. Guide dogs were the original service dog. They are a form of service dog that specifically helps blind people. One way to tell the difference is that guide dogs wear a harness when they're working, while most other service dogs just wear vests. Guide dogs were the first dogs that were trained specifically to help disabled people. But now there are lots of different kinds. Wheelchair support dogs, seizure alert dogs, diabetic alert dogs, dogs for deaf people. The list goes on and it just keeps growing. I think it's great, although it can get a little dicey, because many service dogs these days seem like they aren't trained to a very high quality. Some users are now owner training because schools can be too expensive or difficult to get into. Or in some cases, service dogs don't even exist for their disability. But they still decide to train their dog to do a task that they need help with anyway. Emotional support animals, however, have unfortunately created a lot of issues for guide dog and service dog users. I've never had more access issues than I have in the last 2 to 3 years, and it just keeps getting worse. As someone who has struggled with depression and anxiety, I get how huge my dog has been in my recovery. But the problem is when people put a service dog vest on an emotional support animal and say it's a service dog, even though it's had no formal training. Legally, emotional support animals have the right to go on airplanes or live in residential communities that don't typically allow pets, and it stops there. But that doesn't stop people from putting a vest on their emotional support animal and taking them everywhere. It gets worse. People have started taking their regular family pets everywhere. These days, people can just go online and buy service dog kits for the low, low price of $200. They come complete with a vest, a fake certificate, and some even a fake doctor's note. Which, by the way, there's no official certification for service dogs. I know they think their actions are harmless, but there's very big consequences for people like me whose lives depend on their dog. Real service dogs are trained to perform specific tasks. They help ease certain side effects or symptoms of disability or medical conditions. And they are vital to the safety and functioning of the people who use them. Lately, when I go places with my guide dog, people try to deny me access because I don't look disabled. They've had bad experiences with fake service dogs who come into their establishments. They bark, jump up on tables, and grab food from plates. So they ask me if they can see my certificate. A, the ADA law states that you're not allowed to ask me that. And B, there's no such thing as a guide dog certificate. So now people expect me, a real service dog user, to show them a certificate that does not exist. This means that fake service dogs with fake certificates are getting access. Meanwhile, real ones aren't because they don't have the non-existent certificate. Can you tell I find this just a tiny bit annoying? You've already heard my lovely story about how I have to hide around the corner so that taxi drivers won't drive off on me. I have problems at the airport now, too. Now, every time I cross the border from Canada into America, I have to go into secondary and show them all my paperwork. It adds a lot of unnecessary time to my travel. Think of how much money people are willing to shell out just to stand in a slightly shorter line at the airport. But I don't even have the luxury of that option. And the only reason I have to do that as a real service dog user is because of all the fake service dogs people are trying to bring through the airport. Being disabled is hard enough. Thank you. My guide dog is supposed to make my life easier, and for many, many years, he did. He still makes my life much easier than it would be with a cane. But now, he adds extra challenges to my life, too, which is extremely frustrating. Also, can we not just get, like, this one perk? I'm already blind. Can I just get the one perk of bringing the dog? Do you have to take my one perk, too? You already get to see and drive a car. Stop bringing your dog places. That's my thing. Many people are still surprised to find out that you're not supposed to pet a service dog while they're working. It's hard to get across the true gravity of this, but it's ultimately a safety risk and puts my life in danger. Guide dogs are trained to know that when the harness is on, they're working, and when the harness is off, they're not. If you pet them when the harness is on, it undermines all the training they went through. This might not seem like a big deal when my dog is looking oh so adorable under the table at Starbucks. But the next thing you know, I'm going to be crossing four lanes of traffic and he's going to be like, I'm not working, I want to chase the squirrel. He's smart, but he still has the brain of a dog. Some people know the rule about not petting a working dog, but then do it anyway. They say, I know I shouldn't be doing this, but then they pet the dog. Guess what? There's no insider club or secret password. It's really simple. When the dog has the harness on, do not pet it. Period. Other people will start talking baby talk or making kissy sounds, which is still distracting. So then, if Gallup looks, I have to say, Gallup, no, and correct him to get his attention back. Yes, of course, they're super cute, but next time you see a service dog in public, the best thing you can do is just admire it from afar. Don't try to distract it or get its attention in any way, shape, or form. Look, I know most people don't mean any harm. Even though it might make you uncomfortable, I'm not telling you these things because I want you to feel bad. I'm telling you because I know you'd want to do better if you knew how it was affecting disabled people. The only way we can create change for the better is by talking about it. A few years ago, I saw a video a YouTuber had posted about how he got his dog certified as a service animal. He did it so it would be allowed to live in his apartment building. I left him a polite comment saying, maybe you need a service dog for a reason that I'm not aware of and you haven't chosen to share. But in case you didn't know, online certification is illegal. It's not real. As you can imagine, this started a long comment thread. A lot of people were defensive on his behalf, but a few agreed with me. I didn't really expect it to go anywhere after that, but in one of his next videos, he said, hey guys, this blind girl commented on one of my videos and she educated me about service dogs. I wasn't aware and I don't use that certification anymore. Instead of getting defensive, he was a big enough person to hear what I was saying, do some research, and then take ownership of his actions. I was able to make a difference with one person, and then he was able to share that with his followers. That's what this is all about. We just need to stop being afraid of saying the wrong thing and keep talking to each other. That's how we're going to change the world. Chapter 7. Look, Mom, I got a job! Maybe it's my Canadian modesty, but it feels weird to say this. I come from a pretty smart family. My brother Brady is highly academic, and everyone thought I'd go to university like him. In my final year of high school, when I started touring universities, nothing felt right. One day, as I was in the car with my mom, I told her, I wish I could just start my career right out of high school. I knew I wanted to help people, and I felt like I could do that without needing to go to university. As always, my mom was super supportive, but it took a while for my dad and Brady to come around. They didn't understand at first, but eventually they realized it would be the best thing for me. What a lot of people might not realize is just how hard it is for a lot of blind people to find jobs. About 80% of blind people in Canada are unemployed, more so than any other disability. We're just as educated and qualified as other applicants, but people are scared to hire us. They assume we're not as capable, so they just hire the sighted person. I had already started to feel the effects of this in high school. Prospective employers were turning me down solely because of my disability. One guy even wrote it in an email. He said, "Because you're blind, we don't believe you'll be able to accomplish the tasks we require of our staff." Yes, that is illegal, and yes, he wrote it in an email. That is correct. Another called me on the phone and told me that they didn't hire me because they'd have to hire somebody else to work with me, and it was just easier to hire a sighted person who could do it on their own. When it was time for me to decide what I wanted to do after high school, I realized that the chances of meaningful employment were questionable, given where we're at in society. There was no guarantee that, even if I went to university, I would graduate with all these great job prospects falling in my lap. I knew that if I was going to have a successful and fulfilling career, I was going to have to take things into my own hands and do it my way. For my 18th birthday, I got tickets to see a Canadian activist who motivates kids to help other kids. I knew I had to find a way to ask this man for advice because he was living my dream. Traveling the world, performing on stages, and sharing a meaningful message that was making a difference in people's lives. I felt awkward putting my hand up during the Q&A, but my mom urged me to raise it higher. I was the last question he took. When he finally called on me, I took a deep breath and said, "I'm graduating from high school this year, and I want to be a motivational speaker. I've been doing it since I was 5. What do you recommend I do as the next step?" He gave a pretty generic answer about how you have to follow your dreams. But as soon as he got off stage, he ran over to me, handed me a card, and told me to email my information to his assistant. The next day, I sent an email with my resume so they could see what experience I had. I never in a million years expected to get a job. I just wanted them to be able to see what I was doing so they could point me in the right direction. At first, nothing happened. Then, 6 weeks later, I was having lunch with my camp friend Matt when I missed a call from their company. In the voicemail they left, they said they were extremely impressed with me and wanted me to come in and talk as soon as possible. Early the next week, I got out of school to go into Toronto and have a meeting at their office. Right then and there, they offered me a full-time job as a motivational speaker. I couldn't believe my dream job had just landed in my lap. It was exactly what I wanted. While everybody else would be going off to college, I'd be touring the world. And, most amazing of all, at least for the next few years, I wouldn't have to face those scary unemployment statistics in the blind community. It was my first grown-up job and my first time out on my own. And I admit, I went a little overboard at first. I had way too much fun decorating my new apartment with all the cute decor from Urban Outfitters and Anthropologie. Don't even get me started on all the adorable dishes and mugs. If I had to give a name to my style back then, it would be boho hippie earth-saving chic. I'm definitely not into this whole minimalist trend. I splurged on my wardrobe too. After all, I had to look the part. For the first time in my life, I gave myself permission to start a little collection of heels, something I definitely never had the confidence to wear in high school. And being the short girl I am, I love nothing more than a good heel. My first pair of heels were these brown suede lace-up wedges from Tom's. They were so cute. I remember feeling so grown up when I put heels on for the first time for something that wasn't a fancy occasion. Like, I'm 18, I have a job, and I wear heels on a Tuesday. My first big performance was for 20,000 people at the Air Canada Centre in downtown Toronto. Kids could earn tickets to watch A-list celebrities perform if they had done something for their local and global community. It was a great way to get kids engaged in activism. I met Martin Sheen at that event, and I still have the rosary he gave me at my very first performance. We ended up working together numerous times, and he adored Gypsy. Whenever he saw her, he'd put in his plug for why he should get her when she retired. At first, he said, she'll love the LA sunshine. I have a nice pool that she can swim in. And when I told him she hates swimming, he said she never has to go near the pool. It was very sweet. He was just so caring, down to earth, and open. As if my life wasn't already amazing enough, that year I started dating Matt. We had been friends for years, but our friendship had grown into something more, and now we were in a relationship. We could make the perfect day out of something so simple, like going to the beaches in Toronto and having a picnic together. To this day, no one else has ever made me feel as amazing as he did. I'm so glad he came into my life when he did, so he could help me through some of the challenges I was about to face. Traveling the world was a dream come true. All through high school, Brady had been going on service trips and volunteering all over the world, and I wanted to be just like him. I've always idolized my big brother. Now, because of my new job, I got to travel to places like Kenya and India, and have all of these amazing experiences that really helped me grow and mature as a person. That's not to say it was always easy. When I was in India, I came down with a horrible sore throat. It was like my insides were covered in paper cuts, and somebody was like, do you know what would help with that? If you drank some acid. It was burning. Not that I actually drank acid, obviously. At that moment, I really missed Canada and my free healthcare and my walk-in clinic down the street. And ice cream. But I was becoming a stronger, more resilient person. One thing life keeps reminding me of, though, is that sometimes it has different things in store for us. Before I give speeches, I always check the mic levels and make sure the projector will work with my presentation. And walk the stage to make sure I figure out how much room I have